So we're going to start. Welcome everyone to this workshop run by iCommons. We are experimenting a bit today because we're doing this as a podcast interview. So we're going to be distributing it on, thanks to New Thinking and Marcus, we're going to be distributing it to the rest of the iCommons community around the world. So what I'm going to do is just start off by explaining a little bit about what iCommons is and what iCommons does. And then we're going to move on to the workshop for today. So iCommons, you can see the website there. It's quite a new organization formed by Creative Commons. Basically, iCommons provides a platform for free culture communities, access to knowledge communities, basically organizations around the world that are working towards the growth of the commons in some way. So it's quite a diverse community composed of lawyers, musicians, artists, videographers, filmmakers, and it's, so we've been going for about a year properly, and we provide this platform that once a year we bring together these people at what we call the iCommons Summit. And the iCommons Summit was held in Rio in June this year, and I can see there's some iCommoners in the audience who were at the event. And the goal really is to try and build this concept of a global digital commons, because a lot of us talk about the fact that we're living in a global digital commons or a global digital era, but really the global concept is not very real. And a lot of countries are really left out of that discussion. So by broadening the discussion and engaging other organizations that are involved in this field, we really are coming towards a point where we're having this really great discussion among equals around the world. And in fact, at the Rio Summit, there were 300 people, and there was kind of equal percentage among the different continents, which doesn't happen that often. So it's a really exciting movement, and there's lots of really exciting things happening within the movement. iCommons really doesn't do much more than bring these people together and offer them a platform. Just to introduce you to some of the other resources to find out more about iCommons, this was the summit in 2006. You can get to it from iCommons.org. These are the people that gathered in Rio to throw Larry in the pool. And here's some podcasts and some stories from the summit. The next summit is going to be held in Dubrovnik, which is, we're hoping that there'll be a lot of European participation in Dubrovnik from the 14th to the 17th of June in Croatia. So if you want to hear any more about it and you're interested in participating, that will be available. Information will be available on iCommons.org. I just wanted to show you one other thing. This is a video that was taken at the summit that was remixed. I think it's been remixed about 8 different times. There's some really amazing creators and creative thinkers that come to this event. And what the videographers did, the people that were making films or television programs for their own countries, was they put all their materials on a server. They had a meeting at the beginning of the summit and said, okay, well, you know, we're all going to be shooting the same thing. That doesn't really make sense. Let's decide what we're going to shoot, and then let's share the footage afterwards. And let's share it under the same license. So let's share it on an attribution license, and then we can work with this footage much better in the future. And so projects like that have had some really amazing successes where people have actually started thinking now about making global documentaries rather than, like in South Africa, they were making a South African documentary. Now they're actually trying to get this footage from other people around the world and actually starting to make global documentaries. So this is one of the movies that was remixed by Nathaniel Stone, who was artist in residence.
Cool! It's not just free beer, it's good beer. Cool! It's not just free beer, it's good beer.
That's Gilberto Gil, Minister of Culture. Brazil.
Turn of the world, camera. World turns, camera.
Just free beer, it's good beer.
Before the world was small, because earth was big. Today the world is too big because earth is small. Of the size of a parabolic camera antenna. Hey, turn of the world camera. Hey, world turns camera.
So that was our moment of glory. Gilberto Gil was at the summit and had some amazing words to say about a global movement like this. But today we have a really exciting workshop planned because we have two really interesting dudes here. Aurel Balkin is the guru or the, what do you call yourself of OS Flash?
I don't call myself a guru, that's for sure.
Okay, so he is the coordinator and founder of osflash.org. Who knows about OS Flash, just for interest sake in the audience? Okay, Aurel's going to be talking a lot more about OS Flash, but it's basically a platform for OS open source developers who work on open source projects on top of Flash. Then we have this stranger on the right called Larry Lessig, who I'm sure you're all sick of hearing from him after speaking so much at the summit, but I mean at this conference. But he's going to be talking a little bit more about the really exciting applications development that Creative Commons is a part of. I know that we flogged kind of the Microsoft Creative Commons debate quite a lot at this event, so we're going to talk more about the future and what kinds of other projects are planned by Creative Commons, and kind of how the proprietary projects like Flash and Microsoft can actually interface, if at all, with these freer platforms. So we're going to start with a short presentation by Aurel, because a lot of you don't know about OS Flash, and he's going to talk about his work and kind of the future of what he sees for open source and Flash. And this is basically, it's quite timely because I don't know if any of you went to Larry's talk last night, but he was talking about the fact that free software developers, or inviting free software developers to be developing more applications for the free culture movement, things like multimedia and Flash in particular. So we're kind of continuing that conversation rather than going back to the conversations that we've had yesterday. Okay.
Thank you very much, Heather. Are you going to transfer that over for me? Okay, great. Thanks. Hi, everyone. It's a great honor to be here talking to you. You're quite a different audience than the audiences I normally speak to, which are, of course, Flash audiences. So I'm very excited to be here and to get the chance to enter into a dialogue with you, hopefully, today at this conference. Let me just see. Okay, my notes are up there. So I hastily put together some notes for this workshop on the way here. And they're a combination of a couple of things. They include some slides, presentations that I've given to various audiences, specifically to a Flash audience and to a web standards or an Ajax audience. And I wanted to include these just to show you where we are as a group of people who care about standards, who care about open source, who care about Creative Commons and licensing, but who also work on the Flash platform. And usually that spot, that place that we're at, it feels a little bit like between a rock and a hard place, because you can never be open enough for the people who are open, and you are way too open for the people who are closed. So hopefully I'll show you how I've tried to approach both of the audiences, with my main aim being to create some dialogue and to hopefully get the open source community, the web standards community, to embrace Flash so that we can take it further and we can influence it. So before I start, I just want to give you a little bit of background on who I am so you know who you're listening to. I flash for a living, which doesn't mean that I indecently expose myself to random strangers, but that I build experiences and applications on the Flash platform. And I also talk about flashing. I enjoy talking about flashing, but usually it's to a Flash audience at various conferences. This year, I've been lucky enough to talk to several other audiences, such as the Deconstruct conference, the web standards community there, of course, here at Wizards of OS, and hopefully there will be a few other conferences where I'll be addressing other audiences apart from the Flash audience. And I also flex. So for those of you who don't know what flex is, it doesn't mean that I flex my muscles or I work out, but rather that I build applications using the Adobe Flex Builder tool or the Adobe Flex Framework, which is a free framework that I'll be telling you a little bit about as we go on, because that really is where we are at in terms of the state of the art on the Flash platform as a technology for building applications. But what really excites me is agile development and extreme programming. I'm very much into development process because I believe that it's development process that determines for us as developers who would identify themselves in this audience as a developer. A couple of you, who would say you are designers? Okay, and creative technologists? I'm grasping at straws here, okay. Great, so I have an audience that I'm not really used to. As a developer, for me, the development process, what process you use daily, is a function of my happiness or the happiness of my team. So it's very important for me to have a process where people can come in every day and do fun things and be happy doing them. So the process is very important. That's why I'm excited by agile development and extreme programming. And also, of course, user-centered development is very important for me for the same reasons. Because if we're creating these web applications, these tools, and they're not meeting the needs of their users, well, they're going to come back to us and they're going to be unhappy and we're going to be unhappy. So it's really about being happy or not. Which is also why I'm excited by usability design, patterns, and testing, and also software architecture. I created an open source pattern-based framework for creating applications in ActionScript 3 and ActionScript 2 on the Flash framework, on the Flash platform, sorry, for this reason. And I release it as open source because I'm very much excited by open source. And finally, what excites me is Evangeline Lilly because, well, she's really hot. So let's start with a talk I gave on Flash at Deconstruct 2006. Now, the way I'm doing this, there's a guy sitting over there. It's a homage to him, and it's not a very good one, so forgive my my lack of execution. So basically, at Deconstruct 2006, a web standards conference, application conference, I gave a talk called Mash My Flex Up. So it was about creating mashups in Flex. Who knows what mashups are? Okay, all right. In this audience, I would have expected all the hands to go up. So mashups are where you take open data. Well, okay, I'm going to contradict myself. Where you take data from several sources, one or more sources, and you present it differently. So and you do this so that you can create new applications. So for example, you can take Google Maps and you can take some other piece of data, like houses, for example, and you can mash those two together and create a new application. So they're really cool. You can remix the web, in a way. So it's very much in line with, I'm sure, what you guys are talking about here at the conference. And Creative Commons licenses will, of course, facilitate this. So I'll get to that in a little bit. This was a talk that I gave there. And I was quite bold in order to get some interest from the Ajax crowd. And I said, can you ever go back to Ajax? Everybody know what Ajax is here? Yeah? Okay. All right. So it's a whole crowd of Ajax developers that I'm talking to. All right. Can you ever go back to Ajax once you use Flash, basically? Bold statement, a little bit of controversy. But also, I wanted to just immediately recognize the elephant in the room, which is there is this disconnect between our communities. There's this big disconnect between, say, the Flash community and the web standards community and the HTML community. And only when we actually acknowledge that and start talking about it, I think, are we going to step over some bridges and actually, you know, build some bridges. So basically, I said this, of course, I was very bold, I was very confrontational, but when I got up on stage, I raised my hands up and I said, don't shoot me, I'm a Flash developer, because it was a very different crowd, of course. So here's a small segment from that presentation. I want to show you this in hopes that it will give you an understanding of how I try to approach this other audience. So here's that presentation. Mashups basically take data or content, what we call information, from one or more sources, and they present it differently. So at its core, you have access to information and the separation of information and presentation. The largest number of mashups today exist in mapping, photos, video, and search. And there's a reason for this. It's because the largest data sets are owned by some of the largest companies who provide these services. So for example, we have Google, we have Yahoo, eBay, Flickr, Amazon, etc. However, these APIs do not equate to open data. And that's because there are API restrictions. These APIs, for example, for me to ask Google for a map that I can use in my own application, I need to sign a contract with them. I need to get a license in order to use their data. And that's not a Creative Commons license. That's just a Google license that their lawyers come up with, right? And they have very strict restrictions on what you can do. For a lot of these, you can't use it commercially. So if you build something that's great, you can't use it commercially. They also require identification. So ID is required. In open source, if you're downloading an open source piece of software, you don't have to tell them, I am Aral, right, to download it. I can just download it and I can use it. I don't have to give any identification. But with these APIs, you do have to give identification. And there's sometimes non-competition clauses. If you use Yahoo Maps data, you can't compete with Yahoo. If you read their terms of service, you can't create something that competes with them. And there are other limitations. But who controls these limitations? The data provider controls them. They have complete control over it. It's their data. They're letting you play with it. But they control the sandbox, the boundaries of the sandbox that you're playing in. So what are these APIs? Are they marketing 2.0? Is it a way for Google to get even more famous? Is it a way for Yahoo to, you know, build upon its marketing program without spending too much money by getting the best talent in the industry to build things for them for free? Or is it a recruitment tactic? If they love, you know, what you've done with their data, they might hire you, they might buy you, right? So is it a recruitment tactic? I don't know, maybe that's being cynical. Or maybe it's just a form of syndication for these companies. Whatever it is, mashups for me are fun, and I see them as intellectual playthings. So there's nothing wrong with that. And sometimes they actually scratch an itch. So just like open source software, a lot of open source software gets created because I want to do something, and I can't do something. And Microsoft is not giving me the tools I need to do something, right? And I can't go to Microsoft and say, hi, Bill, you know, I need this tool. Can you guys build it for me? And, you know, you don't even get in the door, right? You can't even talk to them. So, but you might go, hey, I've got this knowledge. I'm going to build it myself. I have an itch. I'm going to scratch it, right, myself. So a lot of open source is about scratching itches. We do a lot of scratching in open source. Mashups do this as well. But APIs are not open data. And here's an example. Wouldn't it be crazy if you paid to have map data gathered that you couldn't then access, but it was sold to an American company that would then license a little bit of it to you under a restrictive license, so it had terms and conditions attached? I mean, that would just be outrageous, right? But that is exactly what happens with Google Maps, which buys their maps in the UK from Ordnance Survey, who gather their data using taxpayers' money, so your money, in this case, our money, because I live in the UK. But you don't have open access to this data at all. Or this. if you pay for the BBC, which is the British Broadcasting Company, it's half public owned, half private in the UK, but people pay for the BBC with a tax. It's known as a TV license, and it is a tax. It's actually been classified as a tax, finally. If you pay for the BBC, why can't you do whatever you please with the data it creates with your money, instead of having to get a restrictive license to, again, a subset of that data from backstage.bbc.co.uk? I'm bringing these up because these services are shown usually as examples or beacons of openness, in a way, of open data, of how we're changing the internet, and we can use these APIs and we can create these amazing things. But they're not really that open. And if you want to find out more about this and these issues, I would urge you to go to freeourdata.org.uk, because they have a lot of information there. And I just realized that if I hold this microphone closer, it's going to sound so much better, and I won't sound like a mosquito, which I should have known from my singing days. But so basically, we're not talking about open data, but access to data. And these APIs are semi-open. Just like something else, the SWIFT format, which is the file format of Flash, which is what the Flash player plays. It is the bytecode that runs inside the Flash player. It is semi-open. And that's not necessarily a terrible thing right now. And that's the point that I was trying to make at this conference, that perhaps we're approaching Flash, because of historic reasons, with a lot of prejudice. The same amount of prejudice, maybe, that we don't apply to other things. And that maybe being semi-open currently, although not ideal, is not a terrible thing. But it could be better. And it might actually get better. To give you an example, Adobe asked me to be among about 10 developers who they asked for their opinions on the last 10 years of Flash, because Flash has turned 10 this year. It's 10 years old. And also, they asked us to look ahead and tell them, well, where do you think Flash is going to be in the next 10 years? So, of course, I answered their questions, etc. But the important bit is, I wrote that we would see a growth in open source, and that we would have tools that complement Adobe's offerings. I also said that open source products are important because they will increase the adoption of the platform with developers, so that if we're calling Flash a platform, and we're calling it a platform today, then we need open source. Open source is a legitimizing factor for Flash as a platform. But of course, in this quote, I'm talking to mainly a Flash audience, and I'm trying to change their perceptions. And finally, and this is the key point, I said that as the Flash platform reaches a certain level of maturity, we may even see open sourcing of the Flash player and Flash becoming a truly open standard. All right, you might be saying, okay, you said that, but the key thing is, they printed it. And they may not have done this a year ago or 2 years ago, having worked with them through this process. The very fact that they printed this, and it didn't go through some editorial process, and they didn't come back to me with, you know that thing you wrote, just that last paragraph, you know, just that one sentence, actually. Could we rewrite that so that it says that, you know, Flash is an open platform, instead of, like, will be if we open source the player? They didn't do that. They printed it. And that, for me, is a positive sign, one positive sign. So fingers crossed, things might be getting better. But I digress. So let's talk about where the Flash platform is today. Some of you might have perceptions of Flash that are maybe frozen in time at a certain point. How many of you would agree with the with what I'm about to say? Flash is a tool for making annoying web animations and banner ads that annoy the living crap out of me. All right, perfect. So, yes, you can use Flash for this. It's very valid, and unfortunately, a lot of people have used Flash for this, to your annoyance and mine. However, Flash is more than this. The example I like to give is the analogy of, well, HTML. If you were to look at MySpace and judge all HTML development today, you would probably have a very interesting view of what HTML development is just by looking at MySpace websites, or earlier in the day, GeoCities websites, right? There are many HTML websites out there that are badly created. What we need to do is separate our views about a technology from implementations of a technology. And it's true that while certain technologies lend themselves more freely to abuse, all I can say, for example, on the HTML side of things is the blink tag. We all remember it, right? And people use the blink tag, but that doesn't make HTML bad. So I want to just give you some examples of what we're doing today on the platform, some exemplary sites and applications that we're building. These were created using Flex. And I'll talk a little bit about what Flex is, because it really is a state of the art on the Flash platform today. The first one I want to show you is called Flex MySQL Admin. And it's the most boring example. And I'm just going to switch to it right now, and hopefully this is going to work. Yay, it did. Okay, now I can't really see it on my screen, so I'm going to be doing this whole I'm about to break my neck thing here. But basically, it's a very simple application. It looks like a form-based application. It's boring, right, like most applications. But basically, it lets you look at your database, if you have a database, and you can do things like script a select from it, and then you can submit your query, and then it does that select from it. So if you've used something like PHP MyAdmin, if you used any sort of a front end for a database, that's all it is. It's really boring. But it's a web application, so it's running in a browser, and as you can see, it's just like Ajax. In fact, Ajax kind of appeared on the scene after we were doing these things with Flash. But it's just like Ajax, and there are no refreshes. This is a web application, but it's actually quite boring. So something that's a little less boring, but again, somewhat traditional. This is the home locator site, where it's actually a mashup between Yahoo Maps and real estate data. So you're looking for a house, right? And you want to do this over the web. What kind of experience can you create to do this in Flash? So let me just take you there. And over here, let's see. Before I flew over here, I was just in Austin, Texas, speaking at a Flash conference there. So I'll select Austin. And it's loading it over here. It's loading all of the houses in there. And I think my internet connection has just slowed down. Okay. Don't let me down now. I think these things know when you're showing it to a group of people. Like there's some sensor built in. When there's more than three people in the room, it's like, I think I'll slow down now. And just watch. All right, so let me just see if I do have a web connection at all by opening up a new browser window over here. I'm just trying Google. I do. Alrighty. Let's do what you're not even supposed to do on a rich internet application. Let's refresh it. See what that gets me. And if not, I'll just jump to my next demonstration because this is not providing a good one. Yeah, no, I don't think it's...
The net just broke.
Sorry?
The net just broke.
It just broke? I told you. They know. They just know. Okay, so none of these demonstrations are going to work, I guess. So I'll just talk to you a little bit about them and briefly and pass that by. So what the home locator does, if it worked, I could have clicked on a city. It would have shown me a list, as you can see on there, of houses. If I selected it, the map would change at the same time in a very fluid manner, and you would see the pictures down there, and you would be able to look at the pictures and add it to your favorites, drag and drop, etc. But that's also something you can do in Ajax. I think one of the reasons why we really need to embrace the Flash platform is there are certain things on the web today that we can only do on the Flash platform, such as video. So the other example I wanted to give was an online video editor. Runs in a web page, it's a web application, you just go to a website, but you can edit video using this. Now think about what other cool implications this could have, what other cool applications you could build with this. You could create a mashup by taking YouTube videos and allowing people to edit them, for example, which is something that I want to work on when I get a little bit of time. But this lets you bring in your own video, bring in video from a USB camera. In fact, I should be able to show you that because it has loaded. So let's see. So in Flash, I can actually do video, and I can take this USB video, allow it to record me here. And here I am, okay? So I can take this video, and I can also let me take this other pod and maybe bring in some video that I loaded earlier. Let me load that in, okay? And then I can do things like, well, let me change the alpha transparency of my video over here. And you see, in real time, I can composite video streams, for example. And again, this is a web application. It's running in a browser, and it's letting me composite and edit video. So in terms of the types of applications you can build, Flash does really give you a very wide a playing field. So this is just one example of something that you can do in Flash that you can't do, say, in a technology like Ajax currently, which is not to say Ajax is bad, but we have certain features. And actually, the one example that I love to give and to show, because it just gets such a reaction, is a Commodore 64 emulator built in Flash, completely in ActionScript 3. So this is a Commodore 64, a computer basically built, an emulator built in Flash. And I think that that also loaded earlier. So here it is. This is all Flash. So if I double-click this, okay, I can't double-click it, could I? Because I changed my battery here. Let me just, and the two-finger double-click on a Mac goes away when you change your battery. I don't know if you've noticed that at all, but you actually have to go into your system preferences and turn it off and turn it back on. So I'm just going to do that because I'm not used to control clicking. All right, so back over here, if I right-click on this, you'll see that it's the Flash player. And what I have there is a Commodore 64. So I'm just going to let my microphone down for a second and just show you. So it's not just, and to show you that it can do other things, like there's some games that they built, and you can just load them in there and run them inside the machine. So in terms of how much Flash has changed from being a simple banner animation tool, a simple tool for building animations and annoying you, to real applications, it has come a very long way. And I think part of the problem is some of our perceptions have been frozen back in time. And this is true for people on the Flash platform as well. When we think of HTML, when we think of Ajax development, we're still thinking that things are back in the browser wars days where, you know, everything was incompatible and most of your application was statements that said, which browser am I running on and let me do things differently. So I think both of us have pretty much changed perceptions. And there's also Flex Mashup that I can't show you because the internet's not working. But it lets you search for books on Amazon and then look for them in your local library automatically. So you find a book on Amazon and then you can see if it's available in your local library in the US. Then you can just go to your library and book it, or you can just book it online from your library. So a great example of a need. So the person who built this wanted to look on Amazon but find the book in his library but had to go to two different sites. So he built a mashup that combines these together, and he used Flash to do it. I'm not going to get technical in this session, but I want to give you an overview of how Flex does the voodoo that it does. So the way it does it, the way you build applications in Flex, which is what all of these applications were built in, you design your interfaces using MXML. Yeah, Exactly, not the flash ID. I got someone there going, wow, okay. MXML is XML. It is XML. So you design your applications using an HTML-like structure. So if you want to put a data grid, you just put a data grid tag. If you want to put a button, you just put a button tag there. It's just like HTML. You script it using ActionScript 3, which is ECMAScript 4. So that's a standard. And ECMAScript 4 is going to be adopted by JavaScript in time as well when the browsers, you know, update themselves. Finally, well, ActionScript 3, it looks like Java, but it smells like Ruby. And what I mean by that is the syntax is very much like Java, but the language itself is very dynamic like Ruby. So anyone do Ruby on Rails here? It's usually big. Yeah, kinda do Ruby on Rails. Okay. So it's a very dynamic language. Everything is an object, but that's as technical as I'm getting. It's optionally typed. It's a dynamic language. Okay. You compile MXML and ActionScript 3 into Swift bytecode. So if anyone's done Java, it's just like Java bytecode that plays in the Java virtual machine. But Swift bytecode basically plays in the Flash player. Oops, sorry. I'm completely lost myself here, and I'm going to take you through this. Bear with me. Here we go. So basically, Swift bytecode executes in the Flash player, which is a virtual machine just like the Java virtual machine. The Flash player is very important because it's the glue that binds the Flash platform together in the Swift format, which is semi-open, just like those APIs that we love, those mashups that we have, which is not necessarily, of course, a terrible thing, but could be better. Swift is output by various things, by commercial products like the Flash IDE, free products, and when I say the Flash IDE, I mean what you know as Flash usually, the timeline, the stage, you know that product that Macromedia and Adobe now makes. It's output by that, yes, but also free products like the Flex 2 compiler. The Flex framework, the compiler, is free. They've released it for free. It's not open source, but it's free. And you can use that to compile applications on Linux, on OS X, on Windows, to create the type of applications that you've seen there. And open source products like MTask and SwiftMill. So MTask is an ActionScript 2 compiler that compiles ActionScript 2 and makes a Swift, and it's completely open source. SwiftMill has its own XML format that it takes and converts to Swift, and that too is open source. They're both OS Flash projects, and you can find them on osflash.org. So that was a segment from a presentation I gave to a web standards audience in a conference where they were talking about building web applications using HTML, using AJAX. And it's interesting, I want to share with you some of the perceptions that I believe were affected because of this. These are some reactions from the web standards and AJAX community following my talk at Deconstruct and the talk I gave at BarCamp London. So basically, the important thing I see here is the panelist Talis magazine, which is focused on web standards, said the Flash platform is a superior environment for open source web development. And they basically say Adobe may own the player, but it's openly distributed and more powerful and capable than AJAX. Now, I never said that, but apparently that's what they got from the presentation. Flex seems quite interesting and is similar in approach to OpenLaszlo, which is an open source tool for creating Swifts again. Frances Berryman, her focus is on microformats, sat in on a session and said, I hadn't seen much about Flex, but I was suitably impressed. The Friends of Ed blog wrote about it and said, the rift between Flashies and web standardistas has definitely been fixed somewhat. And really, we do have to take ourselves more lightly, I believe, in this thing, because it's usually Flash, oh, I hate it. Crappy Flash, I'm going to go on Slashdot and I'm going to say something bad about Flash, right? People get really angry, we need to just take a breath, I think, and kind of look at what we're doing and look at each other and go, what are we concerned about? I think we're concerned about the same things. I think we're concerned about standards. I think we're concerned about building applications in a nice way, maintainable, scalable, about usability, about accessibility. Believe it or not, we are concerned about that. And the Friends of Ed blog, for example, couldn't believe it. They say, agile development, extreme programming, user-centered design. It's interesting to see these techniques applied to the Flash world, and they are. We do care about these things. We're not just building banner animations. Ollie Hodgson said, presented Flash to me in a new light. And then we have, of course, it's not all positive. So we have Alan Bradburn who said, I'm not 100% convinced, it just seems so unopen. And it is. It is unopen, but this is a process. And it's a process that we have to work through. And this is just a funny one, so I kept it in there. Thankfully, not seeing Aral Balkan murdered for enthusing about Flash in front of a room full of Ajax developers. Basically, the Flex Builder tool is based on Eclipse. So that was very interesting for people to see, because they sometimes work with Eclipse-based tools that are open. And we have a very big, very strong open source community as well. But my favorite comment that I read was from Christopher Heilman, who's part of the Web Standards DOM scripting team. And he said that we need to get this chance, that this is a chance we have right now, to kind of work with Flash and include it as part of our process, part of what we're doing. So basically, include Flash in the WASP Web Accessibility DOM Scripting Task Force, or in WASP itself, so that we can actually work together, and so we can influence things. And also, over here, Jeremy Keith, who's also in the DOM Scripting Task Force, said, it's important that the accessibility community can reach out to liaise with the Flash community. Because it's the key thing here is, do we ignore it? Do we say it's bad, it's evil, it's caca over there, we don't care about you? Or do we say, we're going to work with you, we're going to see what you're doing, and we're going to try and influence you, and we're going to try and make you better, and we're going to try and lead you in the right direction? Because otherwise, how are they going to get there? And what about the people on that platform who care about these things, who are completely orphaned from everywhere else? Who are they going to hold on to lead that platform in the right direction? So I think I'm out of time. I did want to show you a talk that I gave to a Flash audience, but I can just skip over that, actually, or maybe come back to it later on. But I hope this gave you like an introduction into where Flash is today and into some of the challenges that we're facing in terms of perceptions. Yes, we're not open on the platform. We're semi-open. But there is an effort and there are people who are trying to make it open. So I would hope that in your communities, you would hopefully embrace and engage that and work with us to lead that platform towards a more open goal. So that's, yeah.
Thanks so much, Aral. That was really, really interesting. Makes me want to look more at this platform, because it's really exciting what things are going on. And in fact, I really do want to speak a little bit more to Aral about his work with osflash.org, because it's proving to be quite an exciting platform for other open source developers. So, but we have a little problem because Larry's going to be leaving for another interview. So I just want to get him to talk a little bit about business development within Creative Commons, and then we can go a bit more back into what Aral was talking about. So one of the main things we wanted to talk about in terms of Creative Commons is Creative Commons team up with Microsoft in June. And I wanted to just get Larry to talk a little bit about how this process happened, and then to talk a little bit more about other business development that's happening within Creative Commons and other organizations and companies that are working with the APIs. So, Larry.
Thank you, Heather. So, okay, so I'm going to eat the mic. So obviously one of the most important challenges for Creative Commons is to make it simple for people to express the freedoms they want their creativity to carry. Make it simple in the sense that though web developers find no problem with cutting and pasting HTML code and putting it on a web page, 99% of the world, if that's what they have to do, won't do anything to express the freedoms they want to run with their content. So an extremely important early adopter of Creative Commons was Movable Type, which made an option, a preference, in the preference box that allowed you to mark your blog entries with Creative Commons licenses, and the person doing the blog entry would not have to think about it at all. From the very beginning of Creative Commons, we've been trying to work with a wide range of people to get them to integrate the architecture for licensing that we have into their applications, so that it becomes very simple for people to mark content with the license that they intended to carry. One of my favorites was Flickr, which built a simple application inside of the Flickr application to make it so people could say, I want my pictures marked with the following CC license. And there's going to be a lot of interesting development in the Flickr context as we begin to think about ways to actually physically mark the image using XMP as the core technology, so that increasingly images can travel as objects carrying the rights that go with them along with the objects. So Microsoft is in that same line. Microsoft came to us and said, we're interested in developing a plugin that makes it simple for people to mark their Office Office documents with Creative Commons licenses. We'd like to offer it as an optional download, and can you help us figure out what we'd have to do that? And the answer is, sure, here's the link to the technical page on the website that shows you how to do that, and they took the link, and then they built the product. We had a lot of back and forth where they showed us the product, and we had a couple suggestions about how to make it simpler. There are some things that I thought were great about the product. For example, unlike Google, they were not afraid to use and explicitly mention the Creative Commons brand. So if you install the plugin, on the file menu, there's an option called Creative Commons, and you click on that, and it says mark with the Creative Commons license. So there's no ambiguity about exactly the structure you're opting into. Google has an advanced search web page where you can filter your search on Creative Commons licenses, but they never actually say that it's Creative Commons licenses. They just say filter it on the following kinds of restrictions. So I thought that was very good about it. We tried to get them to release the plugin as an open source application. Microsoft actually has some very good open source licenses themselves. A number of them qualify as free software licenses. And given that they didn't really intend to be making any money off of this application, why not put it out there and allow the community to actually develop it? That was one step too far for them. But in the same way that we moved the Flash community, we moved the Microsoft community. Critical thing to realize, though, is that when Creative Commons does these kinds of quote partnerships, they are not in any sense a partnership. We don't make any money off this. We don't ask for any money to help people enable them to enable Creative Commons licenses. We want this to be enabled in every single application and platform that there is. We want it to be simple for people to choose the license. But we don't want to do it in a way that in some sense compromises the mission, so that we would ever be dependent upon a particular view of what the future should be in order to fund our operation. So in this particular case, all they did was develop the product, and then they wanted to come to Heather's conference to announce it. So they came to Heather's conference to announce it. Heather, not having the same standards as we do, said, oh, please give us some money so you can help fund the conference. But that was a process that's totally separate from the integration into the platform. We're talking to a bunch of people about doing this. I think as more people begin to recognize the need to mark content with CC licenses, they want to enable their clients or users to do it very easily, especially in the online video context, for example, YouTube. They're talking about how they could enable people to select CC music or CC videos in the context of the videos that they're remixing so that they don't have any copyright issues when they actually put the videos up. We want to be infrastructure. And so to be infrastructure, you're going to have to have relationships with people who are actually building the infrastructure. There's been one of the reasons I came to this conference was that we really want to encourage the free software or open source software community to help contribute to that infrastructure. So with a little bit of prodding from me, WordPress was willing to match AMP movable type in offering a plugin to make it simple to mark the WordPress objects with CC licenses. But there are a thousand other contexts in which open source and free software products are trying to produce content that ought to integrate the opportunity to mark that content with free licenses that ought to be running with that content. And that requires a decision by open source and free software developers to take the free culture question seriously. And that's the real continuation of what I was saying yesterday.
Okay, I'm sure there are lots of questions, and I think we've spoken enough. The way it's going to work is that, unfortunately, because this cable is pretty short, you have to come here and speak into the mic.
We're not trying to intimidate you in any way.
I'm really sorry about that, but it would be good for other people to hear your questions, because I'm sure there have been a lot of questions, and you will have the same questions as other people. So, any hands for questions? Marcus.
Hi, I have a question about the new Microsoft Zune player. Maybe you heard the rumor that that it shall violating Creative Commons. I have no clue if it is just a rumor, but maybe you can give us your impressions.
Right, so as you know, the new Zune player enables people to wirelessly share content with other people. And all of the content that's being shared is automatically wrapped in DRM that puts a time limit on the content that can be shared. So if you take a CC song and you share it during your Zune player, DRM is restricting the life of that CC song on the other device to 3 days. I think that's the number. That's a problem in the context of Creative Commons licenses because the license explicitly forbids the use of DRM that would restrict the rights that the license is otherwise granting. So if you have a Creative Commons marked content song, that gives you a perpetual right, or as long as the copyright is, which is perpetual, to copy and play and remix that song. And so if you use DRM to limit that to just 3 days, then you're violating the terms of the license. This is literally, I just saw these emails yesterday inside the Creative Commons HQ about this, and we're going to have conversations with Microsoft about this. You can understand there's a little bit of an architectural struggle that Microsoft is going to face about it. So let's say Microsoft says, okay, if we see an object is marked with a CC license, using either we mark in the ID3 tag in the MP3s, or again, we're going to use XMP and every other digital object to mark the content. If Microsoft says, okay, if it's marked with a Creative Commons license, then we won't apply DRM to it. Well, so for CC license content, that's great, but that creates a real incentive for people to lie about the CC license. And obviously, we're not happy about people lying about CC license content. That creates a lot of trouble for us. So this is the... this is the balance that they're going to have to think about, we're going to have to think about. In the MP3 context, when we released a protocol to allow people to mark MP3s with Creative Commons licenses, we had a little trick that said basically that you can also include an authenticating link back that authenticates the fact that this content is licensed under a CC license. The reason we did that is that if somebody marks a Madonna song, I don't think she's a CC supporter yet. So if somebody marks a Madonna song with a CC license and puts it out there on the web, we want a way to actually make it so you can turn off the license, so that you can use the standard forms like the DMCA to go and say, take the authenticating link down. And if the authenticating link's down, then if you try to verify the license, it won't verify the license. So that's a way to kind of turn objects into web pages, because basically the same responsibility can be attached to an object as to a web page. And it might be a similar solution is going to be necessary here for this. I'm quite sure that the developers inside the huge company of Microsoft who are developing Zune just, you know, don't think about things like free content. And so the part of Microsoft that was eager to push the Office plugin, you know, we'll obviously have to begin to talk to them about it.
Alec.
Hi, I have a question maybe for both of you regarding cooperation with other commercial entities, I guess, that are involved, for instance, already in the free software movement, right? And you don't really see them supporting, say, creation of Creative Commons tools, right? Mozilla Foundation is not supporting the CC Moz plugin. And I'm wondering whether you have an opinion, why is that? You just said that the Zoom developers don't really care about open content, it seems, you know. OpenOffice doesn't step out from what I know and talk about making a similar plugin and so on. And is this, you know how sometimes when you look at really wide social movements, the support is lacking, you know, how, I don't know, you know, companies that are into environmental movement don't necessarily drink fair trade coffee at their meetings, though it might make sense. It's not like they have to, but it might make sense. So what's your take, maybe why it's not happening and what could be done here?
Well, Mozilla is a great example. In the days before Mozilla was Firefox and a really hot new browser that was earning literally millions of dollars by the referrals that it was putting through the Google search bar, we had a conversation with them about how they would architect Firefox, because Firefox was going to have the pull-down search options, and the question is which search engines would be bundled inside the pull-down search options. I can tell you that companies like Mozilla, even though they're, you know, supported by open source or free software values, don't think about these questions any differently from Microsoft. They think about what's going to increase market share. And so when we were making the pitch to include a CC search bar in that Mozilla pull-down, their question was, what possible reason would we have to enable people to find CC licensed content? Well, it was their general counsel at the meeting who said, well, this is an obvious reason. Let's say you're a company, IBM or Exxon, and you want your people to go out and make presentations using Flash or PowerPoint or Keynote. And you want these presentations not to include copyrighted material, because you know that if your employees go out using copyrighted material that doesn't have permissions attached to it, you're exposing yourself to liability. Well, here's a simple way to search to find the kinds of stuff that you as a business can allow your people to put into your presentation. So they thought about it in a very practical way, about why would it make the browser more valuable. And frankly, that's all I expect of them. I don't go around saying you ought to be supporting the movement, even though I do think they ought to be supporting the movement. I go around trying to convince them why this is important to their users. And that's exactly what Microsoft thought about it. Microsoft wasn't really, you know, how do we support the free software movement? That wasn't like what was bothering Bill Gates as he went to sleep that night. It was, boy, you know, we are the biggest platform for content development out there. More people develop content in the Office platform than in any other platform, right? So we ought to make it easy for people to do what 100 million people are doing, or 100 million objects are doing out there on the web right now, mark their content with licenses. So we need to do more of that. Quite frankly, The problem with it is is capacity. It takes a lot of effort to begin to do that kind of business development, and so part of what we depend upon is people outside of Creative Commons really taking charge of these projects in appropriate places. So, in the Flash community, there have been a lot of important people who have nothing to do with us. We don't pay them, but who have been proselytizing the idea inside of the Flash and now Adobe environment, and that's what we need more of, certainly need more of it in the open source and free software space.
I completely agree with everything you've said there, and just as a developer, as a Flash developer in this case, who is very much into Creative Commons, who's very much into the various Creative Commons licenses and uses them, both for creating content, remixing content, and when I release things, I release them under various Creative Commons licenses. So my tutorials, code that I release, I even release code under Creative Commons licenses, actually, not the code licenses, because I would love to have a version of the BSD license under Creative Commons to release it under that, for example. So it's completely, almost like an attribution license for code. But as someone who does that, I started building a component in Flash, for example, a while back. I think this was before the APIs existed, and I kind of hit a stumbling block, and we talked about that at one point. It's time as well. I mean, as a developer, I let that stalled. So I want to go back to that, and I want to build that so that people can add Creative Commons into Flash files from the Flash IDE. I want to build one that actually lets you add Creative Commons licenses from the Flex IDE, but it's also a matter of time and effort. So sometimes I think that's also part of the question.